I'll go find it.
证件。
他们是一边去。
Is today the first of the lunar month? What, 50th?
Not today.
Not today, okay.
Oh.
Okay, we... Is it carrying to the... Yeah, that's amplified. Okay, we begin with homage to the Buddha.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Okay, today we will be taking a sutta called the Anumana Sutta. This is sutta number 15 in the Middle Length Discourses. And in our book, this is on page 190. And this is a sutta which is spoken not by the Buddha himself, but by the Venerable Mahamoggallana. Mahamoggallana was one of the two chief disciples of the Buddha. We know that the Buddha had two chief disciples. The number one disciple was Venerable Sariputta, who is the foremost in panya, that is the exercise of a wisdom. And Mahamoggallana was said to have been the foremost in what we call in Pali iddhi, which means spiritual powers or psychic powers. I think we came across these a couple of weeks ago. These are like the powers to fly through the air, sink into the earth, walk on water, travel through walls and mountains, and travel over vast distances just with the blink of an eye. But besides being an expert in the use of the psychic powers, Mahamoggallana also gave very inspiring and uplifting discourses to the monks, which deal simply with different aspects of spiritual training, not instructions on how to develop psychic powers, So if any of you are keen on developing psychic powers, the discourses of Moggallana in the Sutta Pitaka are not going to be very helpful. But if you want to get them, you can come to see me afterwards. Okay, and then the theme of this discourse is on, you say that it has several interwoven themes, but a key theme is knowing oneself, knowing the defilements in one's mind, and making the effort to overcome them. And it's what's the types of defilements that are mentioned here, and this is quite important, is they are those defilements which play a critical role in preventing the achievement of harmony and cooperation in a group. That is, we could say it's those defilements which are obstacles to the communal harmony of the Sangha. The Buddha and Mahamoggallana teaches them with specific reference to the monastic Sangha. But we can say that these defilements are obstructions to the harmony of any group of people who come together for a common purpose. Whenever people come together for a common aim, they have to work together in harmony. And this means that each one has to take the responsibility for subduing within his or her own mind those quite natural human motivations, those quite human drives, which tend to disrupt the harmony of the group and to produce conflict, divisions, and the formation of antagonistic factions. In the Vinaya, it's occasionally said that the harmony of the Sangha depends on the monks and the nuns being ready to criticize one another, not with malicious intent, but in order to point out one's faults. And then when they point out the faults, it also has to be done with the intention of helping one to emerge from these faults, to, we could say, to rehabilitate oneself, to uplift oneself. And so because the spiritual development of the individual within the community depends on this process of mutual admonition or mutual correction and mutual rehabilitation, we have a particular stress in the Buddha's teachings on overcoming one particular fault and developing a particular virtue or good quality. This fault is in Pali default is called being dubaccha, which comes from the prefix dur, which means sometimes bad or sometimes difficult. You know, the word dukkha, which means suffering, also comes from dur plus ka. So that means a bad state, which is suffering. But this is dur plus vaccha. Now the word vaccha means speech. And so dur plus vaccha, dur plus vaccha, we get the word dubaccha, which doesn't mean being a bad speaker. But it means being difficult to speak to. Or we could say being difficult to admonish, difficult to correct. So sometimes if a person is behaving wrongly, engaging in improper conduct, then one has to call that person aside and speak to that person to point out their fault and try to correct them. If that person doesn't accept one's advice, advice that is correct and well-intentioned, then that person is dubaccha, difficult to speak to, difficult to admonish. I used to know a person like that who has really had that fault some 35 years ago. He was an American who became a Buddhist monk. And he went to Sri Lanka. And it really took him a long time to deal with that fault. But people can change. Okay, the opposite of that is suvaccha, which it has the prefix su, which means good or easy, plus vaccha, meaning speech. Now we get this word in the famous Metta Sutta, this discourse on loving kindness. It comes suvaccho chasamudu anatimani. And I've seen people who know Pali really well sometimes translate this word in the Metta Sutta, he is of gentle speech. Or he is a good speaker. But it doesn't mean that. It means being easy to speak to, easy to correct, easy to admonish. Okay, now Moggallana is going to deal here with a particular problem that arises from these two qualities. And that is that some people, again, this is a natural human fault, think that they are suvaccha, easy to speak to, when they are really dubaccha, difficult to speak to. And so here Moggallana is going to enumerate some of those qualities that make a person dubaccha, difficult to speak to. So he starts off, first he calls the attention of the monks, then he says, even though a bhikkhu, a monk, asks thus, and the word that's translated asks, it's actually a weak, the English rendering, it's weak compared to the Pali. The Pali word is pavareti, which means something like invites or requests. So he says to the others, he invites them, please criticize me. Please correct my faults. So he's saying, let the venerable ones, that's his fellow monks, let them admonish me. I want to be admonished by the venerable ones. So he's speaking, sort of opening up the door to being corrected by the others. as though he's coming on as a really humble, respectful, diligent and sincere student who wants to be corrected by his senior brothers in the Sangha. Okay, so even though he speaks thus, he might still be difficult to admonish, and he might have qualities that make him difficult to admonish. He might be impatient, and he does not take instruction or guidance rightly. Okay, so in that case, then his fellow monks will think, this person shouldn't be instructed or shouldn't be admonished. He shouldn't be instructed. And we should consider him as a person who's not trustworthy, or maybe better, a person with whom we shouldn't become close and intimate. And this is an extremely important decision that monks might make in relation to another monk, because for any monk or any person to progress in the Dhamma, it's important to receive guidance from others, particularly when others point out one's faults and try to correct one's misbehavior. And so if one is going to really make progress, then one needs people more experienced, more knowledgeable, when they see you do something wrong, to correct what you're doing. And when they see that there are things you don't know, to give you instruction. And so if the monks decide with regard to this person, we're not going to admonish him, we're not going to instruct him, then that person won't have much chance of making progress in the spiritual life. The Buddha calls this capital punishment in the discipline of the noble ones. There's a sutta, a little sutta that comes in the Anguttara Nikaya, where the Buddha asks a horse trainer how he trains the horse. And then the horse trainer says, sometimes I train the horse by harsh treatment, sometimes by prodding him or by enticing him with a reward. Sometimes I have to use both. Then the Buddha says, and what do you do when none of these methods work with the horse? Then the horse trainer says, then I kill him. It sounds a little strong. Then the horse trainer says to the Buddha, and when you get a disciple, how do you train him? Then the Buddha says, sometimes I train him with rough treatment. That is, I point out his faults. I tell him he has to correct himself. I criticize him. Sometimes I train him with gentle treatment. I point out the benefits of observing the discipline, the benefits of the practice. In that way, I encourage him. Sometimes I have to use a combination of both. And sometimes I have to use a combination of both. Then the horse trainer says, and what do you do if the disciple doesn't respond to any of these methods of training? Then the Buddha says, in that case, I kill him. Then the horse trainer says, but you're the great teacher. Certainly you don't take the life of one of your disciples. You don't take the life even of an insect. How can you take the life of one of your disciples? Then the Buddha says, if I have a disciple who doesn't accept any of these methods of treatment, then I decide and the good monks decide that we won't speak to him and give him any kind of instructions. And that is what is called capital punishment in the teaching of the Noble Ones. Okay, so now Moggallana raises the question, what are the qualities that make him difficult to admonish? And I have to say that even though Moggallana here is speaking to the monks about a monk within the order, we should recognize that, as I said earlier, that all of these qualities are relevant to any attempt to live together in a community, to live harmoniously in a community and to function in harmony for some common purpose. Okay, so the first is that the monk has evil wishes and is dominated by evil wishes. And if you want some examples of what is meant by evil wishes, then we find some mentioned in Sutta number 5. On page 110, he says, I think this is again Moggallana speaking, and he says, in paragraph 9, he says, blemish is a term for the sphere of evil, unwholesome wishes. Then what are some examples of these evil wishes? Here, if a monk commits an offense, that's a breaking some of the rules, then he has the wish, let the other monks not know that I've broken the rule. If he breaks the rule and the other monks know about it, he wants them to admonish him privately, not in the midst of the Sangha. Then I'll just skip over a few, just to select a few, just to give you some ideas. Paragraph 13, when the Buddha is giving a teaching, sometimes he teaches by asking one of the monks questions to be answered. The monk thinks, let the Buddha ask me the questions, so he could be showing off that I have so much knowledge. Okay, 14, when the monks are going on alms round in the village, let them put me in the first place or somewhere forward in the line, not in the back. And when they're assigning seats, let me get a good seat or the best water, the best food. When it's the turn to give the blessing after the meal, may I be the one who's selected to give the blessing, not some other monks, and so on. Paragraphs 21, 24. Oh, let it be the case that the monks, nuns, men lay followers, women lay followers, honor, respect, revere, and venerate me, not some other monk. So you could say that all of these are, you could say, ego-centered wishes. Let me be number one, the superstar, the one who stands out, not somebody else. Okay, then number two is in a way related to that. You could say it's driven by this, what's called the evil wishes. Here, the monk praises himself and disparages others. So in order to get people to respect and revere him, to give him the first place, so he'll praise himself and disparage others. I'm just laughing because this must have been about 2 years ago. There came a monk from India to Zhuangyan Monastery, and he was sitting with me in the dining hall. And we were exchanging a few words. He was an elder monk. And then he asked me, "Did you ever go to India?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "Did you ever go to Darjeeling?" I said, "Yes." Then he said, "Where did you stay in Darjeeling?" I said, "Oh, I stayed at, there was a place that functioned both as a Buddhist temple, as an orphanage. That's where I stayed." He said, "Oh, that's my temple." "The monk who's running that temple, that's my disciple." Then he asked, "What kind of food did he give you?" And I said, "Venerable, this was 1999, that was 9 years ago, one meal, I don't remember." He said, "You don't remember the food that he gave you? What kind of mindfulness do you have?" "I remember every meal that I've ever been given." Okay. Number three, the monk gets angry and is overcome by anger. This is when people are criticizing him. Okay, then number four, when the monk gets angry, if he becomes repeatedly angry towards the particular person, then he becomes resentful towards that person. This is, we call this kind of hostility that builds up, because a monk doesn't like to be criticized, and so he develops a kind of persistent grudge or resentment against those who criticize him. Okay, then number five, when the monk is angry, then he becomes, it's said, stubborn because of anger. This seems to imply that he becomes persistent in his misbehavior, and he seems to be trying to ward off any attempts to criticize him. So he just hangs on to his fault and refuses to admit that he's wrong, that he did something wrong. Okay, as we go on, six, the monk becomes angry, and then he utters words, he uses the expression bordering on anger. You know, he doesn't actually break out in an angry tirade, but, you know, he could feel that venom spilling forth behind words that are attempting to be polite and respectful. Of course, presumably he's talking to those who are his elders in the Sangha. So he's saying things that are bordering on anger. Number seven, it goes a little further. In this case, he's being not simply corrected politely, but now his case seems to have become so serious that he's being formally reproved. This means that the Sangha has met as a group in order to deal with his specific case. And so it's not just a case of one monk or two monks speaking to this misbehaving monk, but they've actually called a meeting of the Sangha to deal with him through some kind of formal procedure. And so when his brother monk reproves him for his faults, then he resists the reprover, refusing to admit that he's done anything wrong. As the discussion goes on, then he will denigrate the reprover. That is, instead of accepting the criticism, he will disparage the character of the reprover. He'll say, "What right do you have to reprove me? You have enough faults of your own. You should look after your own faults. Don't bother to be reproving me." Okay, as they go on, then he will counter-reprove the reprover. This means that he will start mentioning specific faults that his critic has committed. They might be real faults that he has seen the reprover commit, or he could start making things up just to just to have something to deflect the attention of the other monks, so that instead of being focused on him, everybody will turn to the critic and start wondering, how could you be criticizing him when you have these faults of your own? Okay, then, number 10, the monk is reproved, and instead of admitting his faults, his misconduct, he prevaricates, that is, he starts telling a stream of lies, or he'll lead the talk aside, that is, he'll bring up some other topic, trying to distract the discussion. Or he'll show anger, hate, and bitterness. Number 11, when the monk is reproved, then he fails to account for his conduct. I don't really know what this specifically means apart from what's already been said. It seems almost just to be summing up the points that have already been covered. Okay, 12. Now we come to a list of inner characteristics, inner qualities, rather than modes of reacting to criticism. So these are the inner qualities that make one resistant to accept instruction and correction. Here, one is contemptuous towards others and insolent. That is, one tends to put oneself forward and to try to dominate and control others. Again, the monk is envious of others, and avaricious. Maybe better, this could be translated, miserly. So he doesn't want to share his possessions with others. Because within the Sangha, for harmony to prevail, one is supposed to not hold on to one's material possessions, but whatever one gets that can be shared, one is supposed to share with others. And so if somebody is avaricious or miserly, then in order to avoid this obligation to share with others, one will become resentful towards others, and then one will become difficult to correct. Okay, again, now number 14, the monk is fraudulent and deceitful. Fraudulent means that he tries to cover up his inner faults so nobody discovers them. And deceitful means that he tries to show himself to possess good qualities that he doesn't really have. For example, the monk might be behaving very casually, just without any restraint, as long as he thinks he's alone. But when he comes down to the communal hall, maybe he knows that there's a group of lay people there who have gathered to make offerings, and so he wants to win their veneration and respect. So as he comes to the top of the hill where he becomes visible to the others, he'll start walking very slowly, trying to look very mindful, keeping the eyes cast down, maybe occasionally pausing as though he stopped to be mindful of an in-breath and an out-breath. See, I know all the tricks. When he gets to his seat, instead of just flopping down in the seat, he'll pause so that lay people who are watching, they'll know, ah, he stopped to be mindful of standing. He's thinking, I'm going to sit. Oh, our Venerable One is so mindful and fully aware. We will make abundant offerings to him. And after he sits, he'll remain as though, you know, he's in the fourth jhana, you know, just not stirring. But every once in a while, the eyes will be darting to the left, to the right. Who's getting the new robe? Who's getting that the piece of cake? Okay, fraudulent and deceitful, then obstinate and arrogant. We've already come across some manifestations of these characteristics. And then number 16, he adheres to his own view, holds to his own views, holds on to them tenaciously, and relinquishes them with difficulty. Those of you, well, just about all of you who have been coming to the earlier classes will recognize some of these qualities. We came across them in Sutta number 7, the simile of the cloth. And you still will have the sheet that I gave out when we took that sutta, where I gave the explanations of these particular faults that come from the Abhidharma and the commentaries. Okay, so these are called the qualities that make him difficult to admonish. If anybody has any questions on these, then at this point, just feel welcome to ask. Nina, yeah. Wait, he's going to be giving you the floating microphone.
I can understand that about everybody, but I would assume that when one wants to be a monk, one has already come to a state of relinquishment and working on oneself. So I'm a little bit confused. Right?
Yeah. Okay, I mean, that's a good question. Don't travel to any Asian Buddhist country, please. Okay, there are many reasons why people become monks, even in the Buddha's time. It was not always because they sincerely want to gain enlightenment and attain nirvana. But people sometimes think, you could see this in the Vinaya. People are having a hard time with the living. They look at the Buddhist monks. They think, oh, these Buddhist monks, how does the phrase go? They get good food, and then when they finish eating, they sleep in well-protected shelters. And they don't have to struggle for a living. Let me go forth amongst the followers of the Buddha. Or they see monks being respected, venerated by people, and they think, here I am, just a simple fellow, everybody is just treating me like S-H-I-T. if I go forth amongst the Buddhist monks, I'll be respected, venerated, and esteemed. So let me go forth. So there are many reasons why people get ordained.
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. Yes, yes, yes. I don't want to say too much. And also it happens with those who sometimes go forth, become ordained with good and sincere motivation. But human faults are very, very stubborn, very difficult to overcome. So sometimes qualities that are lying dormant in a person's character, when they get into a situation, certain situations, these are causes and conditions, those qualities come to manifestation. The Buddha, he uses a simile, I think with reference to India in that time. He says it's like the bride who newly comes to her husband's home. Of course, in India, when a woman gets married, she goes to live in the extended family of her husband. And so when she first arrives, she's very humble, very respectful towards the elders in the family, very obedient towards her husband. These are Indian virtues. Very compliant. But after she becomes well established in the household, then she starts scolding her husband, "You do this, you do that." She starts scolding her in-laws, her mother-in-law, her father-in-law, "You do this, you do that." And she becomes intolerably domineering. And so the Buddha says, in the same way, there can be a young person here who goes forth into the homeless life. At the beginning, he's very humble, very respectful, very obedient, very compliant with the training. But once he gets established within the order, then he becomes domineering, bossy, aggressive, and unwilling to follow the training. So this does happen. It's human nature. Any additional questions? Okay, then we'll go on. Okay, this is the way I see major sections, the way to divide the sutta into several major sections. What we've covered up to now excuse me from paragraph 2 up to the end of paragraph 3, or section 2, up to the end of section 3, are the qualities that make a person difficult to admonish. Now we have the converse, what I would call section 2, the qualities that make the person easy to admonish. And so here we have the opposite case. So even though the monk doesn't ask his fellows, inviting them to admonish him and to correct him, still he might be easy to admonish and have qualities that make him easy to admonish. He might be patient until accept instructions properly. In that case, his fellow monks think that this is a person who should be admonished and instructed, and they think that we should trust this person, or we should become intimate with him, friendly with him, close to him. And so, as I said earlier, for the monk to progress, to develop, it's important to gain the advice of others, especially when one is behaving improperly. one's misbehavior should be admonished, and one should be corrected, and one should be shown how to rehabilitate oneself, how to behave properly. And so this monk, who is easy to admonish, even though he doesn't invite advice from others, he's going to receive that advice when he needs it. And so what are the qualities that make him easy to admonish? Again, those of you who like always to have positive statements, you have to get accustomed to the Indian, especially the Buddhist way of exposition, which is often just to negate the negative qualities. So here, the monk has no evil wishes, he's not dominated by them, he doesn't praise himself and disparage others, he doesn't get angry easily, he doesn't become resentful, he's not stubborn, he doesn't speak words bordering on anger. When he's reproved, he doesn't resist, denigrate the reprover, he doesn't counter-reprove the reprover, he doesn't prevaricate and so on, he accounts for his conduct, he's not contemptuous or insolent, not envious or avaricious, not fraudulent or deceitful, not obstinate or arrogant. Please, let's have something a little more positive. Let me try. From paragraph 12, section 12 on, he's not contemptuous. Okay, let us say he's respectful and humble. He's, what was, instead of being envious, he's empathetic. When others, is that a legitimate word? When others get certain benefits, certain honors, he doesn't envy them, but he rejoices in their achievements. He's not avaricious, so whenever he gets material gains, he's willing to share them with others. If he has some knowledge, he's willing to share it with others. He's not fraudulent or deceitful, but he's honest, straightforward, somebody who shows himself as he really is. He's not obstinate or arrogant, but he's compliant, flexible, adaptable, and humble. And then he doesn't adhere to his own views, hold on to them, but he's ready to relinquish them easily. If he sees that he's wrong, he'll give up his mistakes and accept the views of others. So those are the qualities that make him easy to admonish. Okay, so that takes us to the end of the second section. Now we come to the third major section, which is the third major division, which is section 6. This gives us the important practical advice of how to go about discovering our faults and eliminating them. And it begins by arousing what I would call the motivation, the resolve, the intention to overcome these faults. And one does this, here Moggallana uses a very skillful method, following the method that the Buddha uses in many cases, in order to train oneself to overcome some faults, one considers how one would react to others who have those faults, how one would evaluate other people who have these faults. Because our mind is so conditioned, I would say it's conditioned in this way, not through outer conditions, but through this beginningless ignorance. The beginningless ignorance envelops the mind in a kind of protective coat. I remember there were these toothpaste ads back, it could be the 1950s, 1960s. There's a man standing a little bit in the distance, then somebody takes, in the foreground, takes a hard ball, or a ball, what looks like a ball of steel, and throws it at him. And so your reaction is, oh, he's going to be hit by that hard ball and knocked over. But then the hard ball hits something that one hasn't seen. It's the invisible protective shield, and it bounces off, and the man in the background is just standing there smiling. And then the ad tells us, in the same way, when you use this toothpaste, it puts the invisible protective shield over your teeth so that you don't get invaded by the bacteria that cause cavities. So the mind puts this protective shield over itself so that we can have all the faults, and we don't really recognize that, you know, when we have these faults, when we step into the room, we think, everybody is glad to see me. When they're really thinking, oh, Sam has arrived. Let's see, what time is it now? Oh, didn't I have some appointment in 10 minutes? Oh, excuse me, Sam, I was just on the verge of leaving. You know, so we have this protective shield which hides our faults from ourselves. And in order to sort of break through that protective shield, we have to consider what would we think of other people who behave in the same way as I do, who act the way I'm acting. And when we reflect in this way, then we would see that we would consider this person to be displeasing and disagreeable to us. And so then what we do is we've sort of stepped outside ourselves in order to look at the world from, no, let's put it this way. What we've done first is to look at another person. Then we use our view of that person as a way to step outside of ourselves and put ourselves into that person's position, looking back at ourselves. And we see that if we have those faults, that person would regard us as displeasing and disagreeable. And so then we have to determine that we're not going to allow those types of faults to arise within ourselves. And if we have them, then we will get rid of them. And so when we do this, then the text says, a bhikkhu who knows this should arouse his mind thus. I shall not have evil wishes and I shall not be dominated by evil wishes. And here the important phrase in Pali, cittam upadetappam. Says the mind should be aroused. What's meant is that one should give rise to the determination or the resolution not to give way to this particular fault. This is the Chinese Yao Fa Shen, right? Correct? Li Bu Zhi Dao Cheng Wan. Okay. So this kind of structure or pattern is repeated for all 16 of the faults. So we don't have to go through them one by one, it's just the same thing. But in each case, one arouses the mind, generates the intention or the resolve not to give way to that fault. So that is section number 3, with paragraph, with section number 7 of the printed text. We come to the fourth division of the sutta, and that is, from time to time, or repeatedly, one has to review oneself or reflect upon oneself in order to discover whether one has that fault. This is the way one avoids giving way to that fault. And so one reviews oneself, and here the key word, Pali word, is
paccavekikappa.
So one should review oneself or reflect upon one's own mind, one's own thoughts, one's own actions, one's own character. Do I have evil wishes? Am I dominated by evil wishes, by this wish to be admired, recognized, put in the best seat, the best food, to get the special position and so on? Okay, then comes the action to be taken as one reviews oneself. As one reviews oneself, if one knows, I have evil wishes, I'm dominated by evil wishes, then one should make an effort to abandon those bad, unwholesome states. But if, when one reviews oneself, one knows, I have no evil wishes, and so on, then one can abide happy and glad, training day and night in wholesome states. And then this is repeated for all of the corruptions or the faults from number 2 to 16. And then in section 8, then we have a kind of summing up of everything that's been said so far in section 4. When the monk reviews himself thus, if he sees that these evil, unwholesome states are not all abandoned in himself, then he should make an effort to abandon them. But if, when he reviews himself thus, he sees that they are all abandoned, then he can abide happy and glad, training day and night in wholesome states. And then the text illustrates this, or Moggallana illustrates this with a simile. Just as when a young woman or man looks at his or her own face in the mirror or a clear basin of water, if they see a smudge or dirt mark on the face, they'll make the effort to remove it. But if they see that the face is clean and without any blemish, then they will be happy that their face is clean. So in the same way, one should review oneself, examine oneself, abandon one's faults, and if one is free from those faults, then one can go on training day and night in wholesome states. And then the commentary to the sutta, the old commentary of Buddhaghosa, it shows the esteem, it makes a comment which shows the esteem that in which the sutta was held. The commentary says that according to the ancient teachers, you know, the early generations of Buddhist teachers, a monk should review or recite the sutta 3 times a day. If they can't manage 3 times a day, then they should do it 2x a day, or at least 1x a day. I'm not going to cover up my faults. I've been very negligent in reciting it even 1x a day. But now that I've reviewed it and gave a talk on it, I say it's extremely useful, a sutta to review, to reflect on, and not only for a monk, but for any person, because when we have to interact with others, when we have to function together in a group, to function harmoniously and effectively, these are exactly the qualities we have to overcome. Okay, any questions that come out from the sutta? We'll have a discussion again after lunch at 12 o'clock. But if any short questions that can be dealt with briefly. Is that Dina back there?
What constitutes training?
Well, training would be the training in all the different aspects of the Buddha's training. It could be the 4 foundations of mindfulness, the development, especially, I think it's referring especially to the development of the meditation. Okay, knock me away.
Knock away.
Wait, take the microphone.
I was just curious about the title, inference. Why inference?
Yeah, inference is used as a title because, I should have pointed this out. If we go back to on page 192, in section 6, we have, now, friends, a monk ought to infer about himself in the following way. That is that process of first you consider how would I respond to another person who has these faults. Then one can draw the inference on that basis. If I have those faults, others are going to think about me in the same way. Okay, we will end the discussion here, and then we'll share the merits, and then come back at... this is an internet question?
Yes.
Okay, this is an important question. Okay, what if the reprover, perhaps out of envy or some other malicious purpose, admonishes a blameless person? How should the blameless person respond? Should he keep silent? Should he walk away and abandon the accuser? Or should he counter-reprove? In a situation where a blameless person is being reproved, certainly is being reproved unjustifiably, certainly he is entitled to defend himself and to call on others who might be able to serve as witnesses to his good character. only in a case where repeated attempts don't bring success to exonerate himself. If he sees everybody is sort of still holding him responsible, then he can keep silent. And if he sees that they're all motivated by some kind of malicious intent, then he should leave that particular sangha and join some other sangha. I mean, I don't mean a non-Buddha sangha, but he should leave that community and join some, he should realize that this is a community which is driven by evil motives, and so he'll leave them behind and go and join some other community. Okay, we end with the sharing of the merits, and today let us especially again direct the sharing of these merits to the people of Haiti. You can practice a little patience. Okay, I'll recite. I'll recite. Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumadipa Shirang Rakantu Sasanam. Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumadipa Chirang rakantu desanam. Akasa ta chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumodipa chirang rakantu mangparang. Eta vatacha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe devanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Sabbe bhutanumodantu, sabba sampati siddhya, sabbe satanumodantu, sabba sampati siddhya. Bhavagupadhaya vichihetato, etantare satakayupapanna, rupi arupicha, asanya sanyino. Dukkha pamucchantu pusantu nibbutin. Okay, we end with the three half bows.